From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, blizzard warnings are posted with some areas of Massachusetts bracing for as much as 2 feet of snow.
Snow will begin late tonight, around 10 p.m. to midnight, but it will really ramp up before the morning commute.
Also, should Massachusetts gun laws be a model for the nation? Senator Ed Markey thinks so.
A license in Massachusetts is only given with the police chief stamp of approval. That's the way it should be across the United States.
And Congressman Jim McGovern takes issue with Education Secretary DeVos leading a commission on school safety.
I'm not a big fan of Betsy DeVos, and I'm really tired of more commissions and more excuses to do nothing.
And essays, fiction, mystery, some recommendations on what to read on a snow day. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, another massive winter storm is headed our way starting tonight. It's our third nor'easter in just 2 weeks. Boston is expected to get as much as 18 inches of snow. Some areas along the Cape could expect as much as 2 feet. The National Weather Service has issued a blizzard warning for the entire coast of Massachusetts starting at 11 o'clock tonight. Some schools have already canceled. The complete list is at WBUR.org. American Airlines has already suspended all flights into and out of Logan Airport tomorrow. Governor Baker said at a press conference today that the length of this storm is going to be a big challenge.
People talking about 12 to 18 inches over that kind of period of time. You're talking about a ton of snow in a very short window, which creates all kinds of serious issues around safety.
And joining us now from the National Weather Service is meteorologist Kim Buttrick. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So the storm's expected to begin tonight. Roughly when and what will it look like?
Well, we are expecting snow to break out between 9 and 11 p.m. this evening. Then it will continue overnight and then come down in earnest on Tuesday. In particular, the heaviest amount of snow seems to will be occurring around the time of the morning rush hour for those that are out and about, say between 5 a.m. and 10 a.m. That being said, it's still going to snow for the remainder of the day. Hmm. It's just that 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. window, that's also when we're expecting the strongest winds, both sustained and gusts.
Hmm. So which areas will be hardest hit?
Right now, we're looking at the south shore of Boston, Plymouth County, down toward the upper Cape of Cape Cod. That's the area where we're expecting the strongest winds. That's where the blizzard warning, or part of the blizzard warning, is in effect. That's also where the heaviest amount of snow is expected, where we could potentially get 2 feet of snow. It could be that heavy, wet, pasty type snow that can bring down tree limbs, trees, power lines. So basically, Plymouth County and the Upper Cape look like it could be the hardest hit based on what we're looking at now.
Hmm. And how about Boston?
Boston, they're also going to get hit hard, too. I mean, it's a big metropolitan area. Anytime you dump a foot of snow in any big city, it can create major problems. They, too, the city of Boston will have strong winds, both sustained and gust, but not as bad as the South Shore down toward the Cape and Islands. But still, they're going to get impact with the snow and the strong winds.
Hmm. How do we compare this to last week's storm?
Well, all three of these nor'easters, the one at the beginning of the month that was headlined with the coastal flooding, the second one, March 7th and 8th, which was headlined with that heavy, wet, pasty snow up in northeast Mass, and now this one, they all three had different components of that nor'easter. This one's going to be mainly the snow headline with some coastal flooding. The one last week, March 7th and 8th, that was the snow was the big story, that heavy, wet snow and the power outages. That was major. And plus, that was coming off the heels of that coastal storm at the beginning of the month that caused the inundation with the coastal flooding.
So we shouldn't see as many outages or flooding from this.
We are highlighting an area of high risk for power outages would be the Plymouth County and the Cape and Islands. That's because that is where we are expecting the strongest winds and that potential for that heavier wet snow And that's a losing combination for power outages.
So you said 5 to 10 a.m. tomorrow will be tough, and it'll start to taper off after that? What are we talking about during the day tomorrow?
No, it'll continue to snow throughout the day, certainly through 8 p.m. Hmm. Sorry, multiple things going on in the background here.
That's okay. So throughout the day until about 8 p.m.?
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about this storm, which is what Governor Baker was saying, is that when you get this amount of snow in a big metropolitan area, you got Boston, you got Providence, you got Worcester, you got Bradley, just the impacts on commerce, all types of travel, rail, sea, aviation, and just regular travel for those of us that have vehicles and the trucks. Just all of commerce gets impacted.
If we do get 2 feet or 18 inches, I mean, at that point, it doesn't really matter. But will it set a snowfall record?
Well, that's a good question. I will look up that
okay.
in the archives. I'll have that ready for the next interview.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. Kim Butch.
Things going on.
Right.
I did not have that one at my fingertips.
All right. Well, we'll stay safe out there. Kim Butchuk, meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
After the deadly school shootings in Parkland, Florida last month, Senator Ed Markey says he'll introduce federal legislation designed to encourage the other 49 states to follow the example of Massachusetts, which has some of the strictest gun control laws in the nation. Markey spoke at Boston Police Headquarters this morning, along with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, some local police chiefs, and some gun control advocates. Markey said thanks to Massachusetts' gun control laws, the state has the lowest rate of gun deaths in the country.
There's no question that Massachusetts usually goes first. We went first on gay marriage. We went first on universal health care. So Massachusetts, once again, has set a standard. It's for gun safety. It works.
WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was at Boston Police Headquarters this morning, and he joins us now. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Deb.
So what would Senator Markey's bill do?
So his proposed legislation, he's calling it the Mass Act, which stands for Making America Safe and Secure. It's also an obvious reference to Massachusetts. And what it would do is this. Through the Department of Justice, it would offer $100 million worth of grants, $20 million over 5 years, that would go to states to provide an incentive for them to follow the example of Massachusetts and several other states, by the way, in the way they license gun dealers and gun ownership. The key piece is this. In Massachusetts requires background checks for all applicants, and it gives police chiefs broad discretion in deciding who gets a gun permit. Police chiefs can deny a permit if an applicant has been convicted of a felony or involved in domestic violence or if they've been institutionalized for mental illness. And Markey says that police chiefs know the community better than anyone, and giving them this kind of discretion is one of the main reasons that Massachusetts state gun laws work so well, according to Markey. Here he is this morning.
Over the past 2 decades, Massachusetts has adopted some of the most comprehensive and effective gun violence prevention laws in the country. And as a result, since 1994, we have reduced gun deaths in the Commonwealth by 40%.
And Deb, there's been some pretty interesting outside study of this. According to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, states with the strictest laws, like Massachusetts, Connecticut, California, New York, New Jersey, have the lowest rates of gun deaths. In fact, Massachusetts has the lowest, as Markey said, while states with the least restrictive laws like Alaska, Alabama, Oklahoma, and Louisiana have the highest rates of gun deaths. So Markey wants to find a way to incentivize states to follow the lead of states like Massachusetts.
At this event today, Anthony, Senator Markey was surrounded by law enforcement, as we said, and some gun control advocates and others. What do they say?
Well, they're supportive of the measure, not surprisingly, of the proposed legislation. Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans is always interesting to listen to on this issue. He talked about the importance of national legislation because he says even though this state has strict gun control laws, illegal guns can still flow into Massachusetts from surrounding states with much weaker laws. And he cited a gun study from a few years back that found many crime guns recovered in Boston come from out of state. And here are a couple of statistics. 25% from the I-95 corridor. That's states like Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina. And 20% came from really close by, from Maine and New Hampshire, which have also relatively weak gun control laws. So here's Commissioner Evans.
You know, we can have all the toughest laws in the world here in Massachusetts, but, you know, when you can go across the state line and basically purchase them without a license or a permit, it does no good.
And Anthony, what about pushback? We hear a lot about the NRA opposing any legislation that would limit the rights of citizens to own guns.
Right. And that's certainly the case here. I spoke to Jim Wallace, who heads the Gun Owners Action League, an NRA affiliate here in Massachusetts. His complaint about giving police chiefs and sheriffs broad authority to decide who gets a gun permit is that it puts the onus on the gun permit applicant to defend and to exercise his or her Second Amendment right. And he says the law is often enforced in a way that's unfair. Here's Jim Wallace.
The problems we've had here in Massachusetts and other states is it's been abused. You have police chiefs for political purposes that just don't like to issue firearm licenses. So they're actually abusing people's civil rights, even though they have absolutely no reason to do so.
And Jim Wallace also says if you're going to spend $100 million, better to spend it on mental health care and finding other ways of keeping guns out of the hands of people with mental illness. Mm.
And Anthony, how about the eternal question? How likely is this bill to go through Congress? I mean, we heard at the top that Senator Markey said Massachusetts could lead the way, as it has on other issues. And we're talking with Congressman McGovern in just a few minutes. He says he has real concerns about the divisions in Congress, particularly on the gun issue. So how likely do you think this might be to become federal law?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, even in the wake of Sandy Hook, the Sandy Hook shooting 5 years ago, the worst school shooting in history, Congress did nothing. Today, we have a president who won't go near this kind of stuff and wants to talk instead about arming teachers. And we have a Republican-controlled Congress that remains very much under the sway of the NRA. So I put that question to Senator Markey and asked, you know, is something going to happen or is this just symbolic? And he said that the reaction by young people to the shootings in Parkland, Florida last month have changed the debate. Here's a bit of what he said.
I think what we're seeing is something that is very powerful, the voices of these young people. And I don't think it's going to go away. Congress is going to have to deal with the reality that this year it's going to be a voting issue across our country.
Markey calls this a children's crusade that could finally force lawmakers to act. And Deb, we'll see if he's right.
All right. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, Congressman Jim McGovern weighs in on the gun control debate and other issues. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to continue the conversation about gun control as well as about some other issues before Congress. And we're joined by Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern to do that. Well, Congressman McGovern says he supports Senator Markey's bill that would model national gun legislation after what's on the books here in Massachusetts. McGovern says the divisions in Congress will likely stymie most reforms.
It's an uphill battle in Washington, D.C., where the NRA seems to own Congress. And, you know, we can't even get universal background checks passed in the House of Representatives or even debated, never mind having a vote on it. So we've been trying to get modest gun safety, gun control legislation before the Congress, and the NRA keeps on pushing back. And I think that's unfortunate. But I certainly support Senator Markey's legislation, and I'm hoping that this movement of young people, of these high school students, not only in Florida but from across the country, that is getting louder and louder and louder. And I think their passion and their commitment, you know, seems like maybe this might make a difference in forcing Congress to actually do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. If you may not be able to get strong gun control legislation through Congress because of the influence of the National Rifle Association, then what do you do about the money?
At some point, you know, people are going to have to stand up to the money and to stand up to this very powerful special interest lobby. You know, I've talked to some of my colleagues who say that, you know, they're afraid to vote for legislation that they agree with because they're afraid they're going to lose their election. Well, my response to them is I'd rather lose an election than lose a child.
But then what do you do to deal with that, right? What do you do about that fear of losing elections and, you know, about the influence of money by special interest groups?
Well, people power has to increase on this issue and a whole bunch of other issues.
If we go back to what Senator Markey outlined today, $20 million in Department of Justice grants to the 50 states to look into comprehensive licensing standards for gun owners and gun dealers. Is that, do you think, a step in the right direction?
I do. I think it is a step in the right direction. Universal background checks, more comprehensive and truly universal background checks ought to be something we can agree on. Right now in this country, if you're on an FBI terrorist watch list, you cannot fly on a commercial plane. Well, I think that's a good thing. But yet you can go out and you can legally buy an assault weapon. I think that's a bad thing. Can we agree that if you're on an FBI terrorist watch list that you ought not to be able to go out and buy a gun? I mean, there are some things that I think I would like to think we could come together on.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what do you think we should do? I know your colleague, Congressman Neal, Richard Neal, has a new plan to address gun violence. He talks about some of the things that you just mentioned, adding people to the no-fly list. And he also says that really Congress needs to allow the Centers for Disease Control to research gun violence. Are those some of the things, or what are your main suggestions for dealing with this issue?
Well, no, I think all those things are good. I mean, we have to understand that there are multiple things that we need to do. We cannot get a debate or a vote on anything gun related in the House of Representatives. The Speaker of the House has blocked every single initiative. And so, you know, we're not going to be able to do anything if it is going to be the approach of the leadership to block everything.
So are any of these ideas, the ideas from Senator Markey, Congressman Neal, or even suggestions that you may have, are any of them, you know, is it pointless to even make a suggestion if you can't even get it forward?
Well, it's not pointless because my hope is that the pressure will continue to build and the Speaker will capitulate at some point and allow these initiatives to come to the floor. But there needs to be more pressure and it needs to be sustained. I mean, we try to use procedural votes every week to bring up a bill to establish universal and comprehensive background checks. You know, but we need more than procedural votes. We need to be able to have a vote and a debate.
How about this idea from the White House to form a commission led by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos that will look at improving school safety?
I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not a big fan of Betsy DeVos, and I'm really tired of more commissions and more excuses to do nothing. What the president has proposed sounds like, you know, let's kick the can down the road and maybe everybody will forget about it.
Speaking of you not being a fan of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, you tweeted today about some of her interview on CBS's 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. And we actually have a clip from that interview. Let's listen.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing?
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should, yes.
And Congressman McGovern, your tweet was that American students deserve better. What do you mean by that? And in fairness, can an education secretary really visit every school in the country?
She can visit every school, but she ought to be visiting some schools that are struggling. And I don't think she has any clue about what's happening in public education. And by the way, there are a lot of good things happening in public education. But, you know, she came to the position she's in by being basically an enemy of public education. Her answer to everything is more charter schools, you know, more defunding of public education. But I found that whole interview troubling because here we have the Secretary of Education going on 60 Minutes and not being able to answer any questions that deal with the realities of education here in the United States.
What could she have offered that would have made you change your mind? You've been against her since she was put in this position. Well, what could she have done anything really that would have made you reconsider your opposition to her?
Well, she, like so many other of his cabinet picks, you know, they get out there and they defend a narrative that doesn't reflect reality. And, you know, for her to say that she hasn't visited any underperforming schools.
Or intentionally visited.
Well, you know, wouldn't you think you would, as Secretary of Education, if there were problems in certain areas, that you would go and you know, you don't have to see every school in the country, but that you'd have an interest.
Let's talk about the $1.5 trillion tax law that was passed last year. According to the New York Times over the weekend, many say this is going to need some tweaking by Congress. And this could affect you in particular because of your role on the House Agriculture Committee. The New York Times identified the so-called grain glitch in this tax bill that allows farmers to deduct 20% of their total sales to co-ops and independent agriculture businesses say that that's going to put them out of business. So what do you think about potentially fixing the tax law, particularly in this very divided Congress?
One of the problems with the tax law was that it was the product of a process that included no hearings and no amendments. And so this thing was rushed to the floor, and there was an up or down vote, and most people didn't know what the hell was in the bill. So if you want to avoid glitches in the future, maybe you ought to have committees of jurisdiction do their work. That means hearings. That means markups and amendments. And that means listening to all sides and making sure that you proofread the bill so that you're not making mistakes. Clearly, there have to be some fixes and some tweaks, but you know, we're going to have to see what they present to us as a whole package, because it's not just one or two things that are going to be that are problematic. There are many things, and you know, as my colleague Congressman Neal would tell you, the Democrats in the Ways and Means Committee, you know, are basically working to kind of highlight where they, you know, where the mistakes are. So at some point, we're going to have to try to figure out a way to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think then that there will be an approved fix, particularly, you know, when it comes to farmers?
I support our farmers, and I want to make sure that they don't get a raw deal. But will they just bring a technical corrections bill to the floor, or are they going to bring a technical corrections bill to the floor plus some other things, you know, that may be problematic for some of us, you know, who didn't like the tax bill to begin with? And let me just say this: the problem with the tax bill is not just, you know, a few groups in this country have been negatively impacted. The problem is that like 84% of all the benefits in this tax bill go to the top 1% income earners in this country.
But I wonder, because of the concerns of the way that this bill was voted on, how is that rancor going to affect the tweaking?
Well, my hope is that, you know, as Republicans bring forward their technical fixes, that they are open and transparent enough to let Democrats bring forward our technical fixes. And I always believe, I'm on the Rules Committee, that a lousy process leads to lousy legislation. And we've had our fill of lousy legislation under this Republican majority.
Hmm. I want to talk about the banking bill that, you know, does give some banks relief from rules that were imposed after the financial crisis in 2008. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure which banking bill you're talking about, because we're constantly dealing with the financial services bills that are essentially repealing the Dodd-Frank legislation,
right?
Which was designed basically to hold some of these big banks accountable, but also to protect consumers. And what I see happening in Washington, based on the bills that are being brought to the floor, is the unraveling of Dodd-Frank. Is the unraveling of modest protections to basically protect consumers and protect our country and our economy from, you know, another, you know, major economic crisis like the one we just dug ourselves out of. You know, it seems that what we're seeing in Washington is basically, you know, a weakening of oversight. And I find that to be very troubling.
Hmm. But some say that the demands of Dodd-Frank caused, you know, smaller banks to close and have tightened credit and have hurt, you know, some small businesses and farmers, right?
Well, you know, I mean, that is the argument that we hear from the people who want to undo any kind of regulation and any kind of oversight. And again, to the extent that any of those arguments are meritorious, I'm happy to work to try to, you know, protect our smaller banks and certainly protect our small businesses and our farmers. But that's just not the case. I mean, what's happening here? Follow the money. Look where all the big financial services industries are putting their money. They're putting their money, you know, into campaigns for Republicans, basically to, you know, to get them to undo, you know, all the regulations and all the oversight of Dodd-Frank. Hmm.
This is an election year. We're 6 months away from the Democratic primary here in Massachusetts, and there are a bunch of races, particularly one among your colleague, Congressman Mike Capuano, being challenged by Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, and this is in the 7th Congressional District. Would you make an endorsement in that race or no?
Yeah, I support Mike. I mean, he's a friend, and I think he's been a great congressman, a great progressive leader. He's on the Financial Services Committee. I know he fights hard to protect consumers. He's on the Transportation Committee, and infrastructure is a big deal in Massachusetts. You know, I know Councillor Pressley not as well as Mike. She's an incredible leader, and I have great admiration for her. So this is not about her, but I think Mike is a good member of Congress who has done a great job for his constituents, and you know, my endorsement doesn't mean anything outside of my district, but. You know, but he's somebody who I think deserves re-election.
What about folks who say, though, there's not a lot of diversity among the delegation? Is it time?
Well, I mean, you know, when I vote for people, I vote based on issues, and I vote based on, you know, their viewpoints and their vision for the future. I mean, I'm a strong supporter of diversity. But to me, at the end of the day, you know, my constituents are impacted, you know, by issues, by policy. You know, if I were in his district, I'd vote for him.
All right. Congressman Jim McGovern, who represents Massachusetts' 2nd District. Congressman, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Happy to be with you.
A settlement has been reached in a class action lawsuit over treating Massachusetts prisoners for hepatitis C. Under the settlement, all Massachusetts inmates with either very advanced or somewhat advanced cases of hep C would be able to receive the expensive treatment within 18 months of the settlement's approval. Joining us to talk about this is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health. Welcome.
Thanks, Deb.
So what's the story with the settlement?
So the story is that lawyers representing Massachusetts prisoners filed this lawsuit back in 2015, and it has a lot of company. In a half dozen other states, civil liberties groups have brought similar suits to get more prisoners access to new hepatitis C treatments. And it looks like this settlement here in Massachusetts is the first one among these suits. Hmm.
And these lawsuits are basically in response to the cost, right, of the new hep C drugs and that prisons were in no rush to pay for these drugs, right?
Right, because of that cost. And it's not just prisons, you know, Medicare and Medicaid were pretty slow off the mark in some cases, too. So the thing is, these new hepatitis C drugs have been around for about 5 years. They have brand names like Sovaldi and Harvoni, and they're called direct-acting antivirals. And they are the poster children for this very American problem we have of high drug prices. Because they're great drugs. They can pretty much cure hepatitis C in a few weeks. And, you know, hepatitis C is a serious and potentially life-threatening disease. It can cause liver damage, liver cancer, and it's contagious, by the way, usually through drug injection or blood transfusions. So it's wonderful that we have cures, but they cost a mint.
So roughly how much per patient? Tens of thousands?
Yes, tens of thousands. When Sovaldi was approved almost 5 years ago, it sparked a lot of outrage because it was something like $1,000 per pill. And it worked out to around $80,000 per person for the whole course of treatment. Now, on the other hand, you avoid a lot of long-term treatments.
Like cancer treatments or other things that could happen if it goes untreated.
Right, or the old hepatitis C treatments.
And how many prisoners in Massachusetts are we talking about that need this treatment?
Well, hepatitis C is very prevalent in prisons, especially prevalent. The lawyers for the inmates in this lawsuit estimated that out of 10,000 people incarcerated in state prisons, more than 1,500 have hepatitis C. Here's lawyer Jonathan Shapiro speaking about this settlement that means they'll get more access to these new treatments.
I'm sure it's going to save lives. I'm sure it's going to improve the health and welfare of prisoners. And to the extent that these prisoners are going to be released to society, it's going to improve the health and welfare of the general population.
So, Carrie, it was probably not really a question about health, but it was really about money, right?
Right. And if you do the back of the envelope math, like let's say 1,500 prisoners, and the treatment price has been dropping, but let's call it $50,000 each, 50,000 times 1,500, that's $75 million. That's quite a budget buster. Now, there's another new drug that's closer to $25,000 per patient. So maybe it would be half that, maybe closer to $30 million. It's still a lot of money.
And it's required by law, because prisoners have constitutional rights to get medical treatment, and these new Hep C drugs clearly have become the standard of care.
Yes.
But of course, prisoners often don't get the medical care that is standard outside of the prison walls, particularly mental health care, as we know. So
yes.
What exactly does the settlement say that they should be getting?
Well, so it basically divides the prisoners into groups, and it gives timelines for how promptly each group needs to get treated. So those with the most urgent disease will get treatment with the new drugs within 12 months. Those in somewhat less advanced or less urgent condition will get treated within 18 months. And that, we're talking there about 280 prisoners who are already at pretty advanced stages. And then there are other groups with other timelines as well.
So this will definitely happen.
Well, yeah, this settlement still needs to be approved by a federal court, but you've got both sides, the prisoners' lawyers and the Department of Correction, agreeing after a whole lot of negotiations about the particulars and the schedules. So it looks like the hard part is done.
And so what does the Correction Department of the Baker administration say about this?
Well, so their attorneys weren't available to speak today, but a statement from the Baker administration says they're pleased to have reached what they call a fair and equitable resolution, unquote, that will lead to better hepatitis C treatment for inmates. And, you know, talking to Jonathan Shapiro, who represented the prisoners, it sounds like the state wasn't at all dead set against treatment, but it kind of took the suit to move it along.
A lot of credit goes to the Attorney General's office, who took a very positive and proactive role in the negotiations.
So, Deb, now the interesting thing will be to see what happens in other states. There's a big pending lawsuit in Florida, and a judge there has ordered the state to really expand its treatment of the 7,500 or so inmates who have hepatitis C. Now, the Wall Street Journal reports that the Attorney General's office there in Florida estimates that it would cost $200 million to treat all their infected inmates, and the state is calling that an outrageous proposal. The Department of Corrections there has asked for more money from the legislature to cover expanded hepatitis C treatment.
And this is a budget issue. The prison healthcare contractors get a fixed budget.
That's right. And in fact, in Missouri, for example, it's been calculated that if the state treated all 2,500 inmates who have hepatitis C with the drug Harvoni, that would add up to more than the entire Department of Corrections budget for inmate health. So, you know, it's so ironic. Like, the advent of these great new hepatitis C drugs actually led to fewer inmates being treated for hepatitis C.
But you mentioned the price drop, and prices are expected to continue to go down. So could that be, you know, temporary?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think we're going to see more movement in this direction. You know, I also spoke in Florida with Paul Wright, the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center there in Florida, which advocates for prisoners, including on this national issue of hepatitis C treatment.
We think it's a really good sign and, you know, hopefully the sign of more to come. Whether or not everyone that's affected with it is going to get that treatment, I'm hoping that'll be the case, but so it remains to be seen how quickly that takes place.
And Deb, he says, you know, if even a judge in Florida, in the Deep South, is ruling in favor of prisoners on this issue, that's a strong indicator of where this issue is going.
All right. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, the latest on the storm and book recommendations for a snow day. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to talk now about preparedness for tonight's big storm. Forecasters are saying expect blizzard conditions and more than a foot of snow in Boston. The National Weather Service has issued a blizzard warning for much of coastal Massachusetts. Some schools, including those in Boston, are already closed tomorrow. A parking ban in Boston goes into effect at 7 p.m. tonight. The exception will be the South End. Some flights into and out of Logan Airport are already suspended. Commuter rail officials say that service will be, quote, extremely reduced tomorrow. Governor Baker today says the real challenge of this storm is timing.
The thing about this particular storm, as it's currently prescribed, is it starts late tonight, maybe even early in the morning, 12 to 1 o'clock, somewhere on the south shore, and just works its way up. And it's going to be peak season for this storm right around the time people are getting out of bed and starting to make decisions about trying to go to work.
Joining us is Chris Bessie with the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. He's on the line to tell us more. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what exactly are we expecting tonight in terms of snowfall?
So the information that we're getting from the National Weather Service has the snow starting, you know, some areas around midnight tonight, but really picking up in the overnight hours and getting quite heavy and treacherous into the morning commute.
We heard about Plymouth and Plymouth County and the tip of the Cape being particularly hard hit. Are those the areas that you are really focusing on right now and perhaps reinforcing?
So there's a couple different impacts that we're watching. So the snow itself, in terms of the amounts, what we're seeing is that the South Shore and into the Cape is expected to be the highest amounts with 18 to 24 inches, but pretty significant snowfall amounts across most of Massachusetts. And the travel conditions are really expected to be bad in coastal areas, when those areas you just mentioned that are under the blizzard warning. That's really low visibility, high winds, and heavy snowfall. So really encouraging people to stay off the roads if they can tomorrow, particularly during the morning and during the height of the storm.
So we did hear that the state commuter rail operator is going to be operating on what it's calling an extremely reduced schedule tomorrow. Advice for commuters, stay off the roads. Anything else?
You know, if you can stay off the roads, if you can work from home, if you can change your schedule to be off the roads during the height of the storm, any of those things help reduce the traffic, or take public transportation if it works with your schedule. Anything we can do to keep people off the roads and let the plows get out there and do their work, we'll get the roads back to normal as quick as possible.
How about outages? What are you expecting?
So what we're hearing from the Weather Service is that generally across the state, the snow is going to be a little bit drier than last week's storm and therefore less of a risk of power outages. But unfortunately for the southeast part of the state and the Cape, the snow is still going to be somewhat wet with strong winds and heavy snow. So we are prepared for the potential for some power outages in that part of the state.
And you're expecting tapering off tomorrow night. Is that right?
Yeah, the National Weather Service is telling us that, you know, it could be very late tomorrow night or even into early morning Wednesday for some areas of the state. So it's going to be a pretty long duration event.
Okay, Chris Bessie with the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. I'm sure we'll be talking with you again. So thanks so much for being with us.
We will. Thanks for having me. Stay safe.
You too. And is there anything better to do on a snow day than curl up with a good book? Well, before the libraries and the bookstores close and the snow begins, we're talking with some local experts about their recommendations on what to read during a snowstorm. With me in the studio, Margaret Wilson, a Boston librarian and a frequent contributor to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
Also with us is Shuchi Saraswat. She's the book buyer for the Brookline Booksmith. Hi, Shuchi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, we also want to tell our listeners, what are your favorite snow day reads? What books have helped you get through the last two nor'easters? Can't believe I'm saying last two nor'easters. And which ones are you looking forward to helping you with this one? You can tweet at Radio Boston. So Margaret, let's start with you. Your favorite snow day book. Tell us, the title and why you like it so much.
Well, this was an easy segment for me because I happen to love a book called Bellwether Rhapsody by Kate Reculia that is set at a ramshackle hotel in the Catskills in the middle of a high school classical music festival where everyone gets snowed in on the anniversary of a mysterious murder that happened there 15 years earlier.
Ooh.
So you have this fascinating motley crew of characters. You have the bellhop who may not be what he seems. You have a young woman who witnessed the murder when she was younger, who's come back to try and solve it and confront the demons that have accrued. And you have all these high school students running around with all of their hormones and the exhausted adults trying to wrangle them and also dealing with their own drama and trauma. And it is such a good read. And perfect for a snowstorm.
All right. Well, that's a good one. How the older book, it seems like, yeah?
Yeah, it came out a few years ago, but it didn't get the attention I think it deserved at that time. And it's one of those books where I recommend it to people and I get a pretty much 100% return rate. People come back and they say, oh my God, that book was terrific.
It's a staff favorite at the bookstore, yeah. too.
Oh, yeah. Really? Yeah. Bellwether Rhapsody. We will tell our listeners, we will have a list of books at our website at the end of the show and remind you that you can tweet your favorite snow day books at Radio Boston. Shuchi, what's your favorite snow day book?
Well, you know, I have just these huge stacks of books. You know, part of working at a bookstore is you always have books to read. And for me, those kind of longer, more epic books are the ones that I end up saying, okay, you know, maybe another day. And the snow day is actually a perfect day to start those books because you want to have time to just, you know, read a good chunk of like 50 pages and really gain momentum on one of those like kind of bigger books. So I've got a couple on my list. I've had the new translation of The Odyssey by Emily Wilson.
I'm dying to read that. Yeah. That sounds great.
So and that's one. And it's just this beautiful book. She's the first woman to ever translate The Odyssey. So
first woman.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's not what I don't want to just start it and have 20 minutes to start and put it down. I want like a good couple hours with that book. So that's one that that I'm hoping to read on a snow day. We'll see if we actually have a snow day tomorrow at the store.
Yeah, both of us may still have to work tomorrow. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know, guys. I'm thinking no. But anyway, just a quick question before you get to the rest of your list, Shuchi, because you said when you have more than 20 minutes, are you really disciplined enough at night to say I'm going to bed in 20 minutes and I'm going to put it down?
For me, at night is kind of – I can't focus as much on a book at night. So for me, it's the morning that I sit down and read. And then, you know, you got to go to work.
You have to, right? You have no choice. Yeah.
And the thing with these really dense, epic books is it can take a little while for the narrative to really get its hooks into you to such a degree that you just keep flipping the pages. So I have a similar idea. I use those big books for long train rides or long bus rides where you just have a big span of uninterrupted time and you can get all that rich scene setting and then have the narrative hooks laid into you. And then you can read it in those 20-minute bursts. Okay. So I definitely get your strategy.
Another book on your list.
Another one. So this book's actually not coming out until April.
Fair. You can't use your bookstore. Yeah. No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Well, this book is called Disoriental by Nagar Javadi. And she writes in French, so it's translated from the French. And it is another kind of the sweeping story of this woman who has been living in France most of her life, but actually had grown up in Iran. And so you get this full kind of two or three generations of stories woven in there about her family in Iran and kind of, you know, the home life in Iran and before they had to flee and move to France. And so, again, it's kind of you're getting a big cast of characters. You're meeting a lot of family members. And just, you know, I had a couple hours with the book yesterday and I just wanted to spend my whole day reading it. Mm-hmm. So that's like, you know, kind of in the vein of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, those stories that are just, they're so expansive that you really just want to sink in with them.
Yeah. And it sounds like maybe one that would have something in common with one of my ideas for a great read for a snow day, which is I want something that's really richly atmospheric, that's just completely transporting you to a different place and time and absorbing you in the material experience of being there. And that can be something where it's cooperating with the snow outside and there's snow in the book and you have this double coziness, or it could be something where you're really being transported to a very different, warmer escape kind of climate. And that's why I picked Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan as one of my books, which is one of these like really, really funny social satires where you have a great idea of the dynamics between the different characters and a really great gimlet eye being turned on the wealthy and the exclusive. It's the kind of book where if someone has a handbag, you know the designer brand that it's made from. But what's really great and different about it is instead of being set in maybe London or New York or LA, these areas where even our fantasy ideas of it are kind of played out, it's set in Singapore. And so you're getting this incredibly rich experience of, for a lot of people, a whole new part of the world and a whole new culture, where you're eating, people are eating these incredible foods and having these different traditions that you're interacted with. So it's terrific. And that's a particularly fun one because it's being adapted into a movie that should be coming out this summer. So people can get on board the Crazy Rich Asians train before everyone else is already obsessed with it.
And then I think there's two sequels
to
that as
there
well.
Are, yeah. Which is another great thing for a snow day read. If you get through the first one, you can grab the next two right away.
What about folks who maybe can't get into the dense books, even on a snow day? Little kids at home, right? Got a lot of shoveling to do. How about essays? You know, there's been a lot of talk about Feel Free, the Zadie Smith book. So
Zadie Smith's essays are just incredible.
And I've started Feel Free. And, you know, one of the great things about her is she can cover such a broad range of topics, but she always sort of starts in with this personal narrative. So, you know, the first essay in that book, she's talking about walking with her daughter through a French market and kind of going past these places that meant a lot to her, these libraries and these old bookstores. And then she finds out the library is going to be shut down and they're going to be building up condos in its place. And then from there, she kind of goes into gentrification and what's happening to these small local businesses. So she starts in this very sort of personal space. And then can branch outward. I mean, she's pretty incredible.
She's such an elegant writer, and she really can take that personal seed and relate it to ideas of general importance in a way that seems almost like a magic trick as you're reading the essays. It's so interesting.
So when would you recommend an essay book versus a dense novel versus nonfiction, or is it completely just up to the mood of the reader?
I think I'm always, the reader's taste is king, in my opinion. What you like is the most valid thing for you to read.
Right. But so in a snow day, though, do you say, well, this day, this is particularly strong, or you can't really make general sweeping statements?
I think time is actually a big factor.
Right.
And, you know, with something like the essays, for example, you can give a half hour to it and you actually like feel that your world is opened up in that half hour. You know, you kind of look out the window a little bit differently than you did maybe before you read that essay. And so I think, you know, if you have kids at home, it's nice to dip into short stories or essays, catch up on the online reading that you haven't, you know, all those essay articles you have like kind of bookmarked waiting to be read. Yeah. That's what I think.
How about read aloud books to folks who have kids at home?
That is one of the things I was just going to throw in.
All right.
So I think it can be a great way to spend a snow day with your kids. Reading aloud is great. It's something you can do with kids much older than you would think, because people have the capacity to be transported by a narrative and to feel that kind of emotional bonding that you get from reading aloud. So the book that I wanted to recommend particularly for that, coincidentally, also is about a hotel where guests are snowed in. It's called The Green Glass
House. I see a theme here.
The Green Glass House by Kate Milford. I think one of the great things about sort of like snowstorms and being snowed in is you get a cast of disparate characters with mysterious motives all held together in one space where all of those motives can ricochet off one another. And I think that's even better in a hotel than in, you know, like a classic manor house with a British mystery, because you can get an even wider array of types. So in this particular book, the hotel in question is a hotel frequented almost exclusively by smugglers who come in with all kinds of weird goods and rarely have the money to pay their hotel bills outright. Instead, they're paying it in waterproof green ink that they're smuggling, or they have pink and green stockings that they need to sell. And a bunch show up in the middle of a week that the hotel is usually empty, each expecting to be there by themselves, each with a mystery
Great. Great. Sounds perfect. I just want to make sure that we get this Twitter comment in here. Casey Brown on Twitter says, Meaty and we are never meeting in real life, both by Sam Irby. Perfect for a snow day.
Oh, they're great.
You both know this.
Yeah, she's a wonderful essayist. Mm-hmm. She's so funny.
These are essays. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not familiar, so those are essays. And then lastly, tell us what you will be reading during the snowstorm tomorrow.
Well, it sounds like both of us might be reading Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng. Mm-hmm.
Neither of you have read this.
Which we're both embarrassed about. Yes. Because
such a great book.
She's a great writer and she's local. And I'm really excited about it because it just got optioned by Reese Witherspoon's production company. So she and Kerry Washington of Scandal are going to be starring in a TV adaptation of it. So I want to get on it because I think it's going to be the next Big Little Lies.
Okay. So Little Fires Everywhere for both of you tomorrow.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, great. And that's another recommendation. I want to thank you so much, Margaret Wilson, a Boston librarian and frequent contributor to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Also, Shuchi Saraswat is the book buyer for the Brookline Booksmith. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And to find their list of recommendations, go to radioboston.org. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.